So, good evening. It's nice to be here again. I have a montage of items to offer you. I'd like to have some time for discussion at the end, so pay attention. I'll start with a poem, sort of the end of the winter, midwinter to end of the winter poem. The dark, it's not really so stark, the dark. Just a time without light, a bark without bite, a time to rest from the glare of the sun, time to get something done or undone. Inside your mother you could not see. The womb of the world is a black hole in space. The dark is the place of fertility. In the dark you can see your original face. Without dark we would not even know there was light. We would never see day without seeing the night. And there's nothing to fear, really nothing to fear. This darkness keeps turning our way every year. And the sun is reborn every year at this time. And out of the dark will be born the sublime and maybe even a new paradigm that will light up the world and continue to shine and shine much longer and stronger each day. So friends, when the winter has truly begun, know that you soon will arise like the sun. This sun. This is dedicated to our dear friend, one of the greatest poets. One of the greatest poets that ever lived. I don't think there's been a meditation retreat that I've attended, or probably anywhere by any teacher in Spirit Rock, where a Mary Oliver poem has not been read. She died last week, in case you weren't aware. The sun. Have you ever seen anything in your life more wonderful than the way the sun, every evening, relaxed and easy, floats toward the horizon and into the clouds or the hills or the rumpled sea and is gone? And how it slides again out of the blackness every morning on the other side of the world like a red flower streaming upwards on its heavenly oils, say, on a morning in early summer, at its perfect imperial distance. And have you ever felt for anything such wild love? Do you think there's anywhere in any language a word billowing enough for the pleasure that fills you as the sun reaches out, as it warms you, as you stand there empty-handed? Or have you too turned from this world? Or have you too gone crazy for power or things? I can't get through reading her poetry these days. Yeah. I love this little piece about the Buddha being visited by a king. The king of Kosala came to the Buddha and described his followers as joyful and elated, jubilant and exultant, enjoying the spiritual life with faculties pleased, free from anxiety, serene, lighthearted, peaceful, living with a gazelle's mind. Do you like that image? When asked why his disciples were so happy, the Buddha replied, "They do not repent the past, nor do they brood over the future. They live in the present. Therefore, they are radiant." In contrast, perhaps, some research New Scientist magazine found in the year 2000, the average American attention span was 12 seconds. In 2013, The average American attention span was down to 8 seconds. The attention span of a goldfish is 9 seconds. And very clever scientific studies at Harvard involving beepers and diaries suggests that an average daydream is about 14 seconds long, and that we have about 2,000 of them per day. In other words, we spend about half of our waking hours, one-third of our lives on Earth, lost in the future or the past. According to the research, people's minds wandered frequently, regardless of what they were doing, except making love. The research also found that people were less happy when their minds were wandering than when they were not, and this was true during all activities. In conclusion, a human mind is a wandering mind, and a wandering mind is an unhappy mind. But we have Buddha Dharma. Nyoshal Kempo Rinpoche says, "Rest in natural great peace, this exhausted mind, beaten helpless by karma and neurotic thought, like the relentless fury of the pounding waves in the infinite realm of samsara. Rest in natural great peace, this exhausted mind." Does that feel like that to you sometimes? A few years ago, the Dalai Lama visited Berkeley and gave a very sobering speech telling the assembled hundreds, "Prepare your mind to know that life is not easy." And he cited our Western desire for perfection and our high expectations as the root cause of our suffering. Sokni Rinpoche, one of my teachers, calls it high-class suffering. And the antidote to our idealism, the idealism of our culture and its desire for perfection, is the first noble truth. This is the condition that we are born into, humans on this particular planet. The problem is, not only do we have a lot to desire here in the overdeveloped world, but we can fulfill many of our desires, at least temporarily. And I think maybe that's why so few of us in the West are getting enlightened. A number of years ago, I took the great American vow. I said it out loud several times. "Desires are endless. I vow to satisfy them all." I call it the Batty Southfoot vow. I think the first noble truth is a balm for those of us who grew up with great expectations. The first noble truth tells us that our failure to live happily is ever after, happily ever after is the key, is not our fault, but due to the conditions of life. In this view, the noble first is an agent of mercy. Don't you think that, you know, you come and you do meditation practice and you kind of in the back of your mind think you're going to get to that place where everything is clear and light and beautiful and without stress and without any kinds of pain or itches, or and you're going to stay that way for the rest of your life? Don't you kind of think that's going to happen? No. Okay, well, this is an old enough crowd to know the truth here and digest the truth. So what I've put together here is a pastiche of a lot of, is that the right word? Pastiche? Yeah, good enough. Of a number of the articles and sayings and teachings that have come my way over the last few years. And I have stacks of them. It's kind of hard sometimes to choose, but it's fun. Okay. "All parts of the earth are built over, trampled, full of commerce. Farms and fields drive back the forests. Even rocks are cultivated. Swamps are drained. Today's towns outnumber yesterday's houses. Everywhere on earth, our residences, peoples, governments, and human growth now so clogs the world, it can barely support us. And as our needs increase, we struggle with each other for them, and nature fails us. That was written by the Roman historian Tertullian in 150 AD. One thing that really disturbed me this week, there's always one or two things, was the announcement that monarch butterflies are endangered, seriously endangered. A recent study by the International Union for Conservation of Nature found that the following percentages of species are threatened with extinction. 21% of all known mammals, 30% of amphibians, 35% of invertebrates, and 70% of plants. Many biologists predict that almost all the corals of the Great Barrier Reef will be gone by 2050. An assessment by the World Wildlife Fund says that this is the last century that anyone will see large animals in the wild. All of those beings can be seen as canaries in the coal mine, an adage that should be taken quite literally in our time of greenhouse gases. We lose 27,000 species each year, 74 every day, 3 an hour. I think the statistics become more alive when you hear the names of those species that are endangered or threatened. I'll read you a few. The Sierra Nevada red fox, the San Joaquin kit fox, the Pacific pocket mouse, the riparian brush rabbit, the Fresno kangaroo rat, all endangered. The big ones, the California bighorn sheep, the stellar lion, the sperm whale, the right whale, the blue whales, the California condor, which is maybe back off the list, the greater sandhill crane, the bald eagle, the great gray owl, the marbled murrelet, the common bank swallow, all disappearing. And what about the plant kingdom, filled with beings whose very names evoke tastes and smells and beautiful sights? The Mount Gleason paintbrush, the succulent owl's clover, Mariposa lily, Crystal Springs fountain thistle, Owens Valley checker bloom, all listed as endangered. How could this be happening? Is this what nature wants? And why have we been chosen as the agents of this Holocaust? Is it retribution for our species' arrogance? For almost all of our history, for all of our history up to very recently, we've been busy protecting ourselves from nature. Now we are being called on to protect nature from us. What can be done? Everything you can do. I won't be able to make it through, but I'll give it a try. I can't do it. Here's a story to break your heart. Are you willing? This winter, the loons. Sorry, I can't read this poem. You have to go and get your Mary Oliver book and read it. It's called Lead, this poem. I think this has been around for a while, but it just came to my attention this last week. Is what Rusty Schweiker wrote about his experience of orbiting the moon back in 1969. He writes, or he said, "You float out, and then you look down. There are no limits to it, no boundaries. You are really out there floating, going 17,000 miles an hour, and there's not a sound. There's a silence, the depths of which you've never experienced before. And that silence contrasts so markedly with the speed you know you're going. And as you stare down at that magnificently beautiful earth below you, you start thinking about what you are seeing, the incredible spectacle of it. And you start remembering your house, your family, your identity keeps expanding, your friends, your nation, your earth. And then something hits you in an instant. You realize that that small blue and white spot is everything that means anything to you. All love, tears, joy, games, all of it on that little spot out there that you can cover with your thumb in front of your face. And you realize from that perspective that you've changed and that there's something new here. Rusty Schweiker. In a book called Timescale by scientist Nigel Calder, he writes, "The master of the planet is grass. It has lured humans into being its slaves, clearing trees and plants out of the way, made irrigation to ensure that the grasses grew tall, especially wheat, rice, and maize. These grasses have recruited battalions of both four-legged and two-legged animals to serve them. The master of the planet is grass." But then Heathcote Williams writes of another master, quote, "If an alien were to hover a few hundred yards above the planet, it could be forgiven for thinking that cars were the dominant life form and that human beings were a kind of ambulatory fuel cell, injected when the car wished to move off and ejected when they were spent." I think that cars have taken over totally now. It feels that way every time I get on the highway and I think, are we living a better quality of life than we were living 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 40 years ago? There really are too many of us. That's the big problem. Some of you will have to go. This is what happens. I do not believe that a multiplication of desires and machinery contrived to supply them is taking the world a single step nearer to its goal. I wholeheartedly detest this mad desire to destroy distance and time, to increase animal appetites, and go to the ends of the earth in search of their satisfaction. If modern civilization stands for all this, and I have understood it to do so, I call it satanic. Mahatma Gandhi. Mm-hmm. And considering what's going on in the world, political world, this seems a really appropriate quote. "The developed industrialized nations of the world cannot remain secure islands of prosperity in a seething sea of poverty. The storms rising against the privileged minority of the earth, from which there is no shelter in isolation and armament. The storm will not abate until a just distribution of the fruits of, the storm will not abate until a just distribution of the fruits of the earth enables people everywhere to live in dignity and human decency." Are we having fun yet? The news is, if you want to be honest, and it's all grist for the mill, you know. It's all life, which is our condition and our lesson plan for this incarnation. In the morning, little piece is becoming much more relevant in recent times for me. "In the morning after taking a cold shower, what a mistake, I look at the mirror. There's this funny guy, gray hair, white beard, wrinkled skin. He's not me, absolutely not. Land and life, fishing in the ocean, sleeping in the desert with stars, building a shelter in mountains, farming the ancient way, singing with coyotes, fighting against nuclear war. I'll never be tired of life. Now I'm 17 years old, a very charming young man. I sit down quietly in lotus position, meditating. Suddenly a voice comes to me. To stay young, to save the world, break the mirror. This has been a topic that I've been very interested in, tried to write about, try to elucidate, try to put it out into the world as Dharma practices. This is Joseph Campbell, the famous mythologist. The old gods are dead or dying, and people everywhere are searching, asking, what is the new mythology to be? The mythology of this unified earth as of one harmonious being. We need a myth that will identify the individual not just with his own self, family, or group, but with the whole planet. Terry Tempest Williams says, the eyes of the future are looking back at us, and they are praying for us to see beyond our own time. They are kneeling with clasped hands that we might act with restraint, leaving room for the life that is destined to come. Evolution. I think that's our mythology, our guiding ideology. Where did I put my... Here it is. As you started your movement, you talked about the bones being... Let them drop into the earth. Is that what the way you put it? Right. It's a wonderful meditation practice to feel... For instance, the bones and the hardness of the bones, and to reflect maybe for a moment that your bones are made of calcium, phosphates, silicates, carbon, essentially the clay of earth mysteriously molded into this structure. You can really feel it. It's the hard part of your body. And then you can feel the moisture around your eyes, your mouth, or the watery nature of your flesh. And if you lick your upper lip or your wrist, you probably will taste the sea, because there'll be a little salty taste there. And then, of course, there's air. We live in this dome of air. It's our planet's shelter, and we're all in here together, breathing. Literally. The earth takes a breath every day, and it takes bigger breaths every year. We just saw the moon, remember? Did you watch the moon? Yeah. And you could really get a sense of the sun over there shining on it, and it was wonderful to see. Evolution. The story of evolution is our collective autobiography. Each of us start life as a single cell, the shape of an egg. Once the egg is fertilized, the DNA code guides it through the history of life on this planet. A single cell grows into a multicelled sphere, into a tubular worm-like body. The embryo grows rudimentary fins, gills, webbed fingers, and toes. Features of reptiles and amphibians as we cycle through the DNA of ancient ancestors. And even after we start to grow arms and legs, we resemble the embryos of pigs and rabbits. It happens in the warm sea of the womb, and at birth we repeat the exodus from the ocean and land in the world. The Buddha told us to as we're meditating, to act, ask ourselves, reflect a little, this construction, self, what is its source? What is its cause? What is its origin? Where do we come from? If you take your arm, you feel there's one big bone up here, the upper arm, and it splits into two bones in your forearm, and then it goes into your wrist and five bones at the end, the digits. All creatures with limbs, either wings, flippers, fins, or hands, have the common design. This is the basic blueprint. Darwin said, it's because we have a common ancestor. Richard Dawkins, a famous biologist, philosopher, says, if you had a picture of your great-grandfather 100 million great-grandfathers ago, and we all had a great-grandfather 100 million great-grandfathers ago, if you had a picture of him, you would have a picture of a fish. Now, some people, I mean, I guess might think of this kind of talk as degrading of the human. I think just the opposite. You probably have heard that the news came out a few months ago that 90% of your body is made up of other living beings, billions of them. Molecular biologists say there are at least 1,000 different species of life inside your large intestine alone. More living beings in your mouth right now than all the humans that ever lived on planet Earth. They have houses and churches in there and, you know. What if these living beings, that, I mean, they're all over our skin, millions and millions of them. What if they got together and revolted and said, decided they wanted to do something that I didn't want to do? Maybe they would prevent me from showering so often because, you know, killing millions of them every time I took a shower. This is obviously not going anywhere, so... Good way to understand your mind is Dr. Paul McLean at NIMH made this scientific breakthrough a number of years ago, I think back in the late 60s, when he discovered we don't have a brain, we have three brains. And they develop in us in the same order they did in nature. We have a reptilian brain, the brain stem. We have the mammalian brain, the amygdala and all the emotional wiring, and the new human brain. And they don't override, one brain doesn't override the older brains. In fact, many of our decisions, the older brains dominate. They're more efficient. They don't have to take time to reason. And most of our new human brain is used to make excuses for the behavior generated by the other two brains. This was the beginning of a book I want or still want to write. It's Causes and Conditions for Everything. I mean, that'd be volumes of encyclopedias, but... For instance, color vision arises. The reason we have color vision is to distinguish ripe fruit from the green leaves. Flowers announce that fruit, nuts, and tubers are growing. Our blood cells got their addiction to salt from the ocean they evolved in. Our arms swing in opposition to the swing of our legs because a few billion years ago, our ancestors with two pairs of limbs wiggled over the mud by throwing their body in an S-curve. We have asymmetrical, wrinkled ears to filter sound waves coming from different directions and in different ways. Astonishment has got to be after, you know, reading about us, astonishment really is the proper response, I think. I mean, maybe, you know, you don't have to be astonished. But, oh, this one. If you took all your DNA, the DNA is so thin, it's about an atom wide. And floating, you're composed of 10 trillion cells, and inside each is a minuscule drop of seawater. And floating in that drop is a strand of DNA 2 yards long. And the reason it can be 2 yards is because the DNA is so thin. Coded in each of these 10 trillion 2-yard strands of DNA are thousands of volumes worth of information on how to build a human being. All the lessons that life has learned over the millions of years, all of them are inside of you. And if you took all your DNA, 2 yards of it in every one of your 10 trillion cells, and laid it all end to end, it would go around the earth a few million times. That's your DNA. Okay, let me see. There's one thing I want to do here. Are you eager to discuss, or are you enjoying this?
Yes.
Yeah? Are you learning anything?
No.
Are you progressing along the path? I want to just read this. This is the last paragraph of On the Origin of Species by Darwin. There is a simple grandeur in this view of life. With its powers of growth, assimilation, and reproduction, being originally breathed into matter under one or a few forms, and while this, our planet has gone circling on, according to fixed laws, and land and water in a cycle of changes have gone on replacing each other, so that from so simple an origin, through the process of gradual selection of infinitesimal changes, endless forms, most beautiful and wonderful, have been evolved. Through the process of gradual selection of infinitesimal changes, endless forms, most beautiful and wonderful, have been evolved. The wife of the Earl of Worcester, when she first heard about the story of evolution, the theory of evolution, said, "Oh my, let's hope it's not true. And if it is, we hope that the idea doesn't get out into the public." So let's talk a while if you'd like. Please, you know, feel free to ask questions or give us answers. I don't know if I can distinguish them exactly. Perfectionism is the demand for no flaws, no anicca, no impermanence. I mean, it's loaded with impossible goals, perfectionism. And the other one was?
Idealism.
Yeah, you can have a lot of trouble with that one, too. It's nice to have ideals. I'm really struck by... I'm addicted to the news on television these days, as many people are. And I'm struck by how it all works, and it works pretty well. It almost makes me proud to be an American. I think we're already great. You know, we have a great system of laws, and but I don't know if that has anything to do with perfectionism, with idealism. I mean, idealism is the belief that something is going to happen that's going to be earth-shaking, right? Like enlightenment. And it's motivating, you know. Some people would never sit down and meditate unless they thought that maybe they were going to get something out of it. Even if it's just calm, you know.
So you weren't saying that they're the same thing. I misunderstood that.
I don't remember saying. I don't remember saying either one. I don't know how they're different. I mean, I kind of know how they're different, but I haven't thought about it a lot. Do you find them different?
Well, I did then. That's why I was asking, because I would say I'm a recovering perfectionist.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's something that I was brought up with. And it is, I do view it as a disease, and it caused me a lot of harm.
Uh-huh.
But I think of idealism as something to set up to live your, like almost a set of, that you can.
Yeah, not strive.
Values
yeah.
To move toward, you know, mm-hmm. have goals to move toward, to be in a better place,
mm-hmm.
Even if it's not perfect. Mm-hmm. So I think of them as a little different, but.
Yeah, no, that's good.
Whether you did.
That's good. Thank you. I like that. I think that's very, very clear. Living happily ever after. It don't happen.
With Arlette, that I don't use the word idealism, but aspiration,
mm-hmm.
or hopefulness, or moving toward a goal, and then the process of refining as we go along.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Kamala Harris was talking about that a bit today in Oakland when she gave her speech about running for president.
Were you there?
No, I wasn't there, but it was on television.
Yeah.
There we go for TV.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that's...
There was a bit on Japan collecting old phones and other electronics and taking the gold out of it to reuse it. I mean, there are ways we can live mindfully, and there is no happy, perfect ever after.
That's right.
Thank you.
Yeah. We can all do better. And part of it is it's not, it's sort of like climate change, although that's caught on as what's happening in a much broader way than endangered species, you know, eradication of species as a disaster that's happening now. Most people, I don't think, are aware of it. I think we should every time another species makes the list, we should put its picture on milk cartons or something, and we should read the list aloud in churches and schools, make it a dominant issue.
There are zoos that are dedicated. There's the Chester Zoo in England, and even the Bronx Zoo in New York, that are working on trying to keep animals from being extinct. But I'm not hopeful. Who's next?
On the issue of Darwinism, what I was always interested in is how it was distorted into the social realm by Herbert Spencer, who created social Darwinism, and I believe that social Darwinism may be at the root of many of the problems of the 20th and 21st century, that if survival of the fittest and natural selection works well incrementally over a long period of time. But in the realm of social Darwinism, it seems to have been used as a justification for eugenics and fascism and everything that's wrong. And it's a distortion. It's a distortion of Darwin and on the origin of species.
Yeah, thank you. Absolutely. It has been misused, misinterpreted.
When you speak, sometimes I think of Mr. Rogers, and I wonder if you have any good Mr. Rogers quotes. He seems like such an aware, mindful, compassionate. I mean, if he wasn't so Christian, he'd be Buddhist.
Well, gee, I don't mind being compared to Mr. Rogers. We have a lot of similarities. I should get a hat like his, a little. Yeah, then the question comes, are we going to wake up in time to what? Save it? I remember Gary Snyder saying, it's a real arrogance to think that you can save the planet. And I think it's obvious that in the next number of years, perhaps the next century, it's going to be really difficult because it's going to be a lot of... a lot of species disappearing, the die-offs, a lot of refugees, people seeking different countries and different places to live, and it's going to be hard. That's why we need the Dharma, really. An infusion of Dharma is really important. Dharma or, some spiritual grounding.
So my ears perked up. I'm looking for a little inspiration. When we're talking about we have such a great system and we're doing so well and we Americans are just, we have it together. Because I haven't been feeling that way, and I also have been watching the news, but I need to take a break.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're far from perfect and, but there are elements of our systems, the checks and the balances and the, they give me hope that it's, a system that will solve its major problems and will, as Martin Luther King said, will find a way to distribute the wealth so that everybody is okay. And that redistributing the wealth, you run into often a lot of problems with communism and fear of socialism, and but we're going to have a lot, I think, a while to that we can experiment with it, see if it, if we can perfect it. I know. I mean, we've got a lot of problems, and a lot, we're carrying a lot of heavy karma. Well, anybody? No?
I've been reading this book called Sapiens.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I know that book.
And it's got some interesting, shocking ideas that are intriguing and I hadn't heard before. And one that pertains to, I think, what we're talking about is that the thing that was unique about Homo sapiens, which is us, is that we developed the ability to construct philosophies or construct corporations or construct
futures,
religions, and then if somebody constructed one, like an LLC or a corporation or a religion, and his concept is that those things aren't actually real. They're constructs of Homo sapiens' brains. And so if you can get enough people to believe in your construct, i.e. A corporation, his view is that corporations don't actually exist, they're just constructs.
Mm-hmm.
And religions don't actually exist. What in his view, what exists is rocks, concrete things, and you know all these other things are. He doesn't use this term, but I'll use it. It's a shocking term. It's the figments of our imagination, and we get other people to believe those ideas. Then this was the thing that led. You get enough people to believe that certain human beings are superior to other human beings, or that all human beings are created equal, and now you can have different groups believing different things, and you create wars. So I'm just sharing this because it was very enlightening. It fit in my mind. It fit with the Dharma. Well, see things as they really are, and you know, when we believe in our constructs, that may not be how things really are, and it's a challenge.
Right. Thank you for that. And that's one reason why we meditate. We meditate to try to touch the real. To really understand the conditions that we live under, the noble truths and the characteristics.
The construct of 200 or 300 years ago was that kings and emperors were superior and they had the right to call the shots.
Mm-hmm.
And the construct we have now is that all beings are created, you know, equal in life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And, you know, we got a bunch of people to believe one or the other of those things, and now there are people on the planet who believe that, you know, tyranny is the right way, and they're superior, and so forth. And none of that is real, exactly, in this view. It's all somebody got enough people to believe it, and that's, in his view, that's how sapiens managed to get enough people together to fight the other guys over there because those other guys didn't have the same beliefs as our group who has the right belief.
Right. The other group has a different name for God.
Yes. Yeah. Anyway, I found this book fascinating in terms of, well, let's break it down to see what, you know, what actually is and what is a construct.
He's got another book, I think, that's since then, since Sapiens. Well, just to offer you a little closing note here. I've noticed that myself and some friends of mine are aging, and it's just a phenomena that is shocking every day. So I got this little piece here. Two distinct moods seem to accompany my aging, both deepening with the passing days. One is poignancy, a sense of fragility and loss in the midst of all experience. I see a family playing with their children on the swings in the park, and while I delight in the scene, I know how quickly those moments will evaporate. I also realize that I will not have those particular worldly joys again. And when I am laughing and joking with my daughter, I sometimes feel the grief of our parting. How does one let go of such delights? Wandering the hills of Northern California, I carry the realization that I will someday be leaving this place that I love forever. Never again will I see the great pines waving through the inflowing fog, or the gnarled sculpture of the oaks standing firm, or smell the vibrant decay of the woods, punctuated with the tang of fennel and eucalyptus. All of it will vanish, along with my senses themselves. Lately, I find that I am missing myself in the world ahead of time. The poignancy that I feel is occasionally associated with my own diminishing possibilities. I don't expect to become a whole lot happier or stronger or more successful than I am now, or even more enlightened. Okay, so maybe I can inch a little closer to the deathless state, but it better happen soon. I know that this poignancy is a symptom of my love for the world and my attachment to being alive in it. Luckily, in counterpoint to the poignancy runs a growing disenchantment with it all. That feeling may simply be age-appropriate, but it's also possible that the teachings of the Buddha have finally taken hold in me. I figure that either I am becoming enlightened or just plain bored. The Buddha was certainly no romantic. He even warned us against becoming attached to those we love, as in the discourse entitled Suffering Born of Those Who Are Dear. Yes, the Buddha does call this human life precious, but that is because humans can understand themselves and end the stream of karma, thereby escaping another birth. The primary goal of this life is to become a non-returner. I sometimes feel that being alive is more of a burden than a blessing, but I am somewhat ashamed of this sentiment. I was brought up in a culture of humanism that cherishes life, and trying to escape another turn on the wheel feels as if I'm betraying my own cause, devaluing everything that I love. Nonetheless, when I hear that life is not a desirable condition, I often feel a sense of relief. If life is not supposed to be easy or enjoyable or filled with obvious meaning, then I can relax. I'm not getting it wrong. This is just the way life on this planet is designed. So at times, my disenchantment with the world and life feels like liberation. The risk is that for me, that feeling too easily slips into indifference, a cold, brittle place where nothing matters. It's equanimity on ice. Besides, I much prefer the feeling that comes from loving the world. I'm sure evolution wanted us to love it. I'm talking about the big love here, where you take the whole of creation into your heart, warts and all, and say, yes, this is worth all the pain and confusion. So love is the answer again. And one thing I love to do is sit around with a bunch of friends who've lived through this era and culture with me and have a good session of laughing and geezing about the Dharma and the drama and the long, strange trip it's been.
Who wrote that?
I did.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. The title of the book is You Are Not Your Fault, which is very clear. I don't take responsibility for it at all. So let's just sit for a couple minutes together.